This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pinchem, and I will be reading summaries of five articles published on December 5th, 2014. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are pituitary surgery, diagnostic and operative techniques, traumatic brain injury, vascular disorders, and oncology. High-resolution 18F fluorodeoxyglucose positron emission tomography and magnetic resonance imaging for pituitary adenoma detection in Cushing disease, a clinical article by Prashant Chittiboyna and colleagues. Pituitary microadenomas that secrete adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH, cause Cushing's disease. These tumors are often not visualized by MRI. Failure to visualize tumors before surgery can lead to decreased cure rates and increased complications. Alternative strategies are needed to visualize tumors that are missed by magnetic resonance imaging. FDG PET exploits the high metabolic activity of ACTH secreting tumors to visualize them. The authors compared MRI with high-resolution FDG PET in detecting ACTH adenomas. They studied 10 patients with pathologically confirmed tumors. High-resolution MRI spoiled gradient imaging detected 7 tumors, while standard MRI detected only 4. FDG PET performed on a dedicated cranial high-resolution scanner visualized 4 tumors, 2 of which were not detected by standard resolution MRI. PET detected no additional tumors that were negative on MRI spoiled gradient imaging. The authors tried to understand why some tumors were not detected on FDG PET. Some clues to FDG PET appearance were found in preoperative biochemical test results. Tumors that were positive on FDG PET had higher midnight and morning ACTH levels. PET-positive tumors also responded less to CRH stimulation. The findings of this study demonstrate that the biochemical phenotype of ACTH-secreting tumors influences their FDG PET appearance. These findings may help devise strategies to detect these tumors when not visible on MRI. Wireless control of intraspinal microstimulation in a rodent model of paralysis. A laboratory investigation by Peter Gran and co-authors. Intraspinal microstimulation is an investigational electrical stimulation technique that involves the implantation of stimulating electrodes to directly excite spinal motor circuitry that is dormant after spinal cord injury. Limitations in neural interface technologies have restricted the use of intraspinal stimulation to the laboratory setting. These limitations include bulky, hardwired stimulation systems that must be tethered to their control systems. In this study, the authors established the use of a wireless stimulation system to evoke controlled responses in the hind limbs of paralyzed rodents. The data show that this system evoked a variety of hind limb movements that were controlled by wirelessly modulating the stimulation parameters. Further development of neural interface technologies, such as the wirelessly controlled intraspinal microstimulation technique presented herein, hold promise for restoring function after paralysis. Impact of intracranial pressure monitoring on mortality in patients with traumatic brain injury, a systematic review and meta-analysis. a literature review by Kyung Wan and co-workers. The authors conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis of studies comparing ICP monitoring with no ICP monitoring in patients who suffered traumatic brain injury, or TBI, to determine if differences exist between these strategies with respect to mortality, ICU length of stay, and hospital length of stay. A total of 14 studies, including 24,792 patients, were analyzed. This study found that the current clinical evidence does not indicate that ICP monitoring overall is significantly superior to no ICP monitoring in terms of the mortality of TBI patients. However, studies published after 2012 indicated a lower mortality in patients who underwent ICP monitoring. Further effort should focus on standardizing ICP monitors and monitoring, and on identifying optimal threshold values for ICP-directed care and distinct subgroups of severe TBI patients who may benefit from monitoring. Impact of early-onset seizures on grading and outcome in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage. A clinical article by Christian Fong and colleagues. Prediction of the outcome in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage has an important impact on physicians' treatment decisions. The most commonly used method for assessing the severity of subarachnoid hemorrhage and for predicting patient outcome is the World Federation of Neurosurgical Societies scale. Although the WFNS scale is widely used, little is known about various clinical conditions potentially interfering with WFNS grading or timing of assessment. Up to 1/4 of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage experience seizures, mostly within the first 24 hours after the onset of symptoms. In this study, the authors evaluated the relationship between these early onset seizures, the WFNS score at hospital admission, WFNS score after neurological resuscitation, and patient outcome 6 months after the onset of subarachnoid hemorrhage. Patients who experienced early onset seizures after subarachnoid hemorrhage had significantly worse admission WFNS scores than patients without seizures, and yet had significantly better outcomes at the 6-month follow-up evaluation. The authors believe that early onset seizures after subarachnoid hemorrhage may lead to low WFNS scores, which could negatively influence physicians' predictions of patient outcome. These results support the current consensus that post-resuscitation clinical status should be used when determining a WFNS score. Quality of life following surgery for large and giant vestibular schwannomas, a prospective study. A clinical article by Mazda Turrell and co-authors. Previous reports have confirmed that there is a significant discrepancy between surgeon-assessed and patient-perceived outcomes of surgery for vestibular schwannoma. To overcome this bias and avoid the drawbacks associated with retrospective studies, the authors performed a prospective study of 100 patients to assess health-related quality of life following surgery for large and giant vestibular schwannomas using the SF36 Health Survey and the Glasgow Benefit Inventory. The patient's preoperative quality of life was decreased in all SF36 domains when compared with normative data. At 1-year follow-up, all patients showed improvement in their quality of life, with more than 60% showing a minimal clinically important difference in various domains. These improvements were sustained at 2-year follow-up in 51 patients for whom extended follow-up data were available. Older patients had a worse quality of life, but surprisingly, postoperative facial nerve function and tumor size were not significantly associated with quality of life. Cultural differences could reflect differences in individual expectations regarding surgical outcome. Therefore, counseling patients prior to surgery with truthful presentation of expected results of surgery may lead to better acceptance of surgical outcomes. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org. Thank you.